Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Now, say, Chatillon, what would France with us?
Thus, after greeting, speaks the King of France in my behavior to the Majesty, the borrowed Majesty of England here.
A strange beginning. Borrowed Majesty?
Salix, good mother, hear the embassy.
Philip of France, in right and true behalf of thy deceased brother Geoffrey's son, Arthur Plantagenet, lays most lawful claim to this fair island and the territories. To Ireland, Poictiers, Anjou, Touraine, Maine, desiring thee to lay aside the sword which sways usurpingly these several titles, and put the same into young Arthur's hand.
Hello and welcome to the Plays the Thing, your podcast for all things Shakespeare. That was King John, a French messenger, Queen Eleanor saying, "A strange beginning, borrowed majesty, you've arrived for King John," a historical play about another illegitimate, according to the French ruler. But this is a very special episode for a very different reason. I am joined by kind of the original tribe that launched the Plays the Thing. I'm here with David Kern, with Heidi White, and with Sean Johnson, who are all part of Close Reads. And if you have paid attention to Close Reads through the years, you know that the Plays the Thing originally began as part of Close Reads, and then something happened. So, David, welcome to the show. I'm gonna talk to you first because I have a question for you.
Okay.
Do you know what happened on August 18, 2018?
Not Paul Revere's ride.
It was not
August
Paul Revere's
18,
ride.
2018.
That's right.
Did I say? I have no capacity for this. Please save the show.
No. Okay. No, you
didn't.
That's
a good guess.
That's okay. A really good guess.
You implied it.
You said, well before August 18, 2018, you were like, hey, let's get together and let's do a Shakespeare play. So on that day, You, Matt Bianco, and me convened for our first ever discussion that ended up as the first show on this podcast, The Plays the Thing. It was act one of King Lear.
Wow. Okay. Really?
Yes.
That's what we started with.
That's what we started with. Now, I think
that's
we
crazy.
Did Macbeth.
Yeah, right.
I think we did Macbeth earlier.
Yeah, right.
But this is the first one that shows up on the stream, King Lear.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So like the first show that was on the actual Plays the Thing feed?
That's right.
Wow.
And today, do you know what is significant about today, you guys?
I don't want to know.
Yeah, Heidi, it's November 13th. It's true. We have to look facts in the eye.
I don't want to talk about it.
Oh, boy.
You guys, this is the last play.
That can't be right.
It's true.
38
We have done all of the plays.
That is amazing.
All of the plays. Now, if you're listening and you're like, oh my gosh, Close Reads is going away forever. That's not true. We're going to continue.
Not Close Reads.
Did I say Close Reads?
This is how rumors get started.
Yeah, Will's the leader. Exactly. I don't know about the plays and things.
That's right. Totally. We will continue to supplement this feed with author interviews and conversations. And we're going to go into our back catalog and we're going to play some of the greatest hits so that you can follow along. But I just wanted to commemorate this recording as the day that we completed all of Shakespeare's works. And Heidi, you might be sad, and I also am sad, but I'm also feeling a little bit triumphant because
fair.
It's not just that it's all the plays, but for most of them, we did act by act and sometimes Q&A by Q&A. It's been
that's remarkable.
A long road. And now
this is going to be like 170 episodes going
on. Oh, it's a ton. It's
well, maybe 150 something.
Yeah, probably closer to 150 because with the minor plays, like King John, we're not doing act by act. We're going to do all of this play, King John, in one sitting.
Then so I guess Tim, you
when
have
can we
done
expect
special
the complete
episodes.
Disc collection.
Yeah,
the complete disc collection will be available on eBay. Yeah, in 2006. What would the packaging look like for the complete Blu-ray collection of the plays, the thing, all Shakespeare plays? What would the packaging look like? Really?
Well, I mean, it'd be your face superimposed on
Shakespeare's
portrait of Shakespeare.
Yeah, your face with Shakespeare's hair.
Yeah.
Gosh, I like that. I really like that. I'll get Graham on that. That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, you guys, King John.
Mm-hmm.
I have a quiz to lead us off.
Make Heidi go first because she's going to get them right.
No, this can be a group effort. You guys can like sound it out together. What are the two things that John, King John, in real history, not in Shakespeare's play, in real history, is best remembered for? Two things.
The Magna Carta.
Nicely done. Nicely done. And what is the Magna Carta, Heidi?
So as we see in the play, the nobles had continual conflict with King John.
Yes.
And he was a manifestly hated ruler. And to this day, the royals never name anybody in the royal family John because of how hated King John was.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's true. Like a royal tradition.
Oh, wow.
They retired the number, but in a bad way.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, Jordan's number hangs in the rafters of Chicago's arena or whatever. King John's name hangs undisclosed in whatever Westminster Abbey.
Like my high school jersey, they hung it up because they wanted a reminder of what not to give people, what number not to give people.
A lot like King John. Yeah. Same. So the nobles rose up against him because he was such a tyrant. And just because also consolidated in history, he was the meeting point of a great amount of medieval political turmoil, right? And so the kings just had too much power over the lives of the ordinary people. There was no parliament, no kind of balancing or harmonizing authority other than just the king and the pope, right?
That's right.
So the nobles rose up against him and forced him to sign the Magna Carta, which was a good document that gave, relinquished some of the centralized power of the crown and provided restraints on tyranny in England. It's a very important document in history, but King John signed it really at the end of a sword. He didn't want to. He wasn't a good man. He wasn't a good ruler, and they forced him to sign it.
There's not a lot of times that like unified rulers in history are like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to divest power. That's what I get. Honey, come over here. What's for breakfast? You know what I'm doing today? I'm going to divest power. That's what I'm going to do.
So the King John that we see in the play is a lot like the King John in
Yeah.
IRL.
That seems right.
Yep.
IRL.
That seems right.
Yeah. How does that compare to the one in the Fox Robin Hood movie, though?
Robin Hood. That's the other
that's
thing,
the
right?
The other thing. Same.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Yep. Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah.
I didn't know either one of those things before preparing to do this show. I'm embarrassed. I call myself a podcast host.
The movie with the foxes?
I've seen it, but I didn't put it together. That was the same King John that we're discussing today. Yeah.
Well, he was called Prince John, to be fair, because that's Richard true. The Lionheart was still on the throne.
Oh,
but he's
okay.
always sucking his thumb and crying for his mommy.
But he was away on crusade, right?
He's, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, so a little bit more history about John. John Plantagenet, the future King John, was the youngest of Henry II's second five legitimate sons. So following the rebellion of his older brothers against the crown, John becomes Henry's favorite child, and he's appointed Lord of Ireland and given all sorts of lands in England. His brother, Richard the Lionhearted, becomes king in 1189. And then on his deathbed, 10 years later, he names John his successor, but it was not considered a legitimate transfer of power by John's younger nephew, Arthur, and by the French, more importantly. The French are like, hey, we see that there might be an opportunity to undermine the British crown. Are you guys interested? And every French person ever resoundingly, Sean, says,
We.
Okay.
I was really hoping you were going to do that.
We are.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where we are when the play begins. And the play doesn't give a ton of that history because Shakespeare audience is going to know it. You know, they're going to come equipped with that. Like we know George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. We come equipped with, you know, plays that deal with those characters. So same thing with Shakespeare's audience. Okay. David, didn't you have a question that you were going to ask?
Oh, like that I mentioned off the air?
Yeah.
Well, it was kind of specific, but I'll ask it. Is it possible that Shakespeare wasn't really into the Catholic Church?
I like how you just put a snack in your mouth after laying that one down on the podcast.
I'm not going to keep going with it.
Yeah,
I'm
listeners, you should see this. It's like he's eating popcorn. David, agent of chaos. Like if he's not the host,
he really is eating popcorn. Doing.
Yes.
If he's not the host, he's wreaking havoc.
That's right.
What makes you ask the question?
Yeah.
Because I was struck in reading this in the way that it seems to, well, I was going to say almost satirize like the papal delegation and all that.
Mm.
But satirize is too strong a word. He's not satirizing. It just sort of seems to not really, I mean, he pits them against the English. And here's an English guy writing plays at a time when, you know, the English were thinking there's a lot of themselves and were also dealing with some turmoil.
I thought there was no Shakespeare play that in which the church comes off as badly.
Mm-hmm.
As it does here.
Oh, cool. I'm not the only one then. Okay.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Now, maybe there's been a whole doctoral thesis written on the Catholic Church and King John. Yeah. I don't know.
I bet there's been 50 written. So, you know, like how scant the information is about Shakespeare. If I were to guess, though, if I absolutely had to guess, I would guess he was a closet Catholic.
Yeah, I've heard that argument too.
But I think in this particular play, the portrayal of the church is more of a literary choice than an ideological one on Shakespeare's part, because the play is largely probably out of maybe any of the history plays. I think it comes at it from, it examines a Machiavellian view of politics. Mm-hmm. And we only have two characters who have any kind of moral center in the play, and they are continually disillusioned throughout the course of the play. And that's of course Hubert and Philip the Bastard. And so I think that in order for him to accomplish his literary purpose from the play, he had to portray the papal legate and the other members of the clergy as being just as Machiavellian as the crown and the nobles in order to accomplish that purpose and that examination of politics.
Yeah, I don't think religion comes off badly in the play. I think that the Rome as a political operator comes off badly.
I guess that's definitely a distinction that needs to be made from my you know, comment that I just tossed out there. So, Tim, are you going to do an episode at some point on Shakespeare, the Secret Catholic?
It would be like 98% speculation and 2%. I think that there, I think his father has been found on a Catholic register. And that's about right. All the information that we have. And so, like father, like son,
and it's just
perhaps,
argument from his plays.
And, yeah. And I don't know that there's much at all to be found in his plays. Like you said, Sean, I mean, the church shows up on occasion, sometimes in good ways and sometimes in bad ways. Let's pause for 1 second. A month ago, I interviewed Dr. Peter Adamson of the History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps for this podcast. And I said, what do you think is the number one philosophical question facing Shakespeare's audience? And he was like, ready to go. Protestant Reformation. Everything changes in the Protestant Reformation, from like authority to the nature of belief to the birth of like the secular sphere as the place that we do politics. And so if that's true, and I completely believe that it's true, then Shakespeare is going to try to steer clear, I think, as much as possible of wading into the central philosophical dispute of his time, because getting it wrong means off with your head. There's a lot of people that were losing their head, you know, during his time. So I think he's very careful, if nothing else, about those cards really
the
close.
Area where he seemed to be less careful was whenever it was like the comments about the sovereignty of the British monarch, right? When John has that line about Italian princes or Italian priests not meddling in British affairs, I can imagine that getting, you know, spontaneous applause when it's originally performed.
Yeah,
this was written when
Groundlings go, yeah, that's right. Don't you forget it? You know,
it was written around the time of the Henry plays, Henry IV parts 1 and 2. So late 1590s, like 1596, 1597.
But it wasn't, it was in the first, one of the folios later, right? Like how often was it performed? Do we know?
I don't know the answer to that. I do not know.
If I were Shakespeare, maybe not that often.
Yeah. Yeah. There are better plays. Wouldn't you prefer, Romeo and Juliet?
I think it's better as this is maybe the only exception to, I don't know. I think this is better to read than to watch. It's actually good, I think, as a literary artifact, because I think the thing that makes it a difficult play to perform is the fact that you can never find your ground and everything's always changing. The terms are always changing. The powers, the locality of power is always changing. Everything that is done in the play is undone.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
the
almost immediately.
The only thing that actually happens in the play is Arthur's death, which isn't even accomplished by anybody but himself. And then some shifting power ground. But where that, I think that makes it a very hard play to perform, but I think that's the point of it on a literary level and on a thematic level. And as a commentary on politics, I think that's kind of brilliant, but it's hard to watch. It's just hard to find your place. You can't put your weight down on anything that's happening
completely
in the play, which is, again, the whole point of this is how politics is. And that's good. Like it just, That's a very interesting contemplation, but I don't know that it works staging wise.
Yeah. The Henry VI plays 1, 2, and 3 are the same way. It's constantly, you're like, wait, whose side is Noble A on? Oh, he's now with Noble G. Who is Noble G with? Oh, he's slid over to Noble Y. And you're like, oh my gosh,
right.
I cannot.
It'll change.
It's like watching, in some ways, it's like watching legislation being made, because you're like, okay, this interest group is now going to side with this interest group because they want item X to pass through. That's kind of what happens in this play and on the Henry VI trilogy also.
Yeah.
I was going to push back on that a little bit. I think it's more like watching Succession, which is fascinating. Like, because they're, that's how, I think if you know the characters, if you know your history, it's fascinating watching it all play out on stage and the negotiations of power and the intrigue. And
yeah,
but if for modern audiences, it's so hard for us to orient ourselves to it because we don't know the history and we don't have the same, this plays out in business way more than it does in politics that we're privy to, right? Anymore, because we don't have the same political system as they do. So I think the history plays are fascinating, and I don't think this is a bad literary artifact. I just think it doesn't work as a play as well as it could, or as well as other of the history plays do, and they are all hard to follow. But when I teach about the history plays, I will always begin it with, what if Shakespeare wrote a play about our modern, like, kings and queens of England? What if he wrote a play about Oprah's interview with Meghan and Harry, right? That's interesting, right? And that's pop culture to us. And we all know about it. And it would be a really good play how they like stabbed the royals in the back because they were coming at it from a woke perspective. And what's the conservative backlash to it, right? Within the public square and behind the scenes. And where do all the butlers stand? Like, that's interesting. But we don't have the proper orientation to these plays because we're just so much further along in history and in a different political arena.
So I think I mostly agree with what you're saying, but I do think that this play sort of collapses under the weight of the artifice of, I mean, and maybe that's why it doesn't work as a play, but even as you're reading it,
artifice. What artifice, David?
So like, you know how you'll read other history plays and he has to fudge how things work on stage to make the machinations of history work. Like, you're like, they're having this conversation. Then all of a sudden this guy appears. And the next thing you know, there's a battle off stage. And the history plays are complicated in the sense that a lot of it had to happen off stage, or they would do some like faux battle with wooden swords and, fake blood and all that kind of stuff. Stuff that movies and TV can, Kenneth Branagh's got the advantage of being able to, stage an actual battle on screen in Henry V. But I think the other plays stand up to the complicated nature of staging a history play in a way that this one doesn't. Like, I find those first three acts especially to sort of, the drama kind of gets sucked out of it because the artifice of it feels so, well, pardon the word, artificial. Like, I don't think he's as nimble in the scene crafting, in putting, in like sort of staging the drama and making the scenes interact with one another in a way that doesn't take you out of it. Whereas like when I read Henry V or some of the Richard plays and things like that, that artifice is not, I'm not like thinking about how it's artifice as much as I am in this play. And maybe that's just me. But so that's where I would say maybe as a reader, and even so confession here, I read this, I kind of had to have Wikipedia near me.
Of course.
Because there were some scenes where I was like, wait, what is happening here?
Totally.
And this is one of even more than some of the other plays, I found myself more confused. And maybe that's because I just have less experience with it. So it could be that is my experiences coming into it and leading me to feel that way. But I also do feel like there's a craft aspect that's just not as sharp as the greatest of the history plays, which maybe that's just, maybe we all just agree with that.
I mean,
Heidi, you probably agree with that too.
I agree with that.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Agreed. I think this play is really enjoyable even as a kind of study for later plays. It seems like Shakespeare begins to craft and perfect a lot of things that he will spin into more fully orbed or well-rounded plays. I think the Philip the Bastard is a really fascinating character, and that he's the only character that sort of stands out. He's he becomes a Shakespearean character in a way that none of the other characters in the play do, and that he has a kind of personality and a charisma. And on the page, I'd love to hear what you guys thought about him. Heidi, you seem to identify him as someone with a moral center. But on the page, I couldn't decide whether he was a self-serving Machiavelli or whether he was a sincere, nice guy.
I had the exact same question. So I want to go to this question. I want to put it to you. But first, I want to hear this monologue from Philip the Bastard. I think it's Act 3 about commodity. So we're going to play you audio. Commodity, as the Bastard is using it, and he's referred to in the play as the Bastard more than anything else. We'll call him that rather than Philip the Bastard. Commodity is self-interest. So listen to this monologue, because it begins with Philip the Bastard kind of raging against self-interest, but listen to the way that it concludes.
Commodity, the bias of the world!
A world who of itself is patient well, made to run even upon even ground, till this advantage, this fire-drawing bias, this sway of motion, this commodity, makes it take head from all indifferency, from all direction, purpose, course, intent. And this same bias, this commodity, this bard, this broker, this all-changing word, clapped on the outward eye of fickle France, hath drawn him from his own determination, from a resolved and honorable war to a most base and vile concluded peace. And why rail I on this commodity? But for because he hath not wooed me yet. Not that I have the power to clutch my hand when his fair angels would salute my palm. But for because my hand has unattempted yet, like a poor beggar, raileth on the rich. Well, whilst I am a beggar, I will rail and say there is no sin but to be rich. And being rich, my virtue then shall be to say there is no vice but beggary. Since kings break faith upon commodity, gain be my lord, for I will worship thee.
That was Philip the Bastard talking about self-interest, commodity. And I'm going to read two kind of chunks of his lines. And Heidi, I really want to hear what you think about him as a character. So the first chunk of lines in the middle of his monologue, this commodity, this bawd, this broker, this all-changing word, clapped on the outward eye of fickle France, hath drawn him from his own determined aid, from a resolved and honorable war to a most base and vile concluded peace. That's the middle. Now at the end, since kings break faith upon commodity, gain be my lord, for I will worship thee. It sounds almost like he's kind of, I think he's changed his position by the time he gets to the end of the monologue. Yeah, Heidi, what are your impressions about this character? I agree with Sean. He's kind of one of the, he sticks out the most, but I found him a little bit hard to place.
Well, and I think that's why he's the best character in the play, is that by far, like by a mile. I think Constance has the most emotionally resonant moment in the play with her grief about her son. And if anybody performs this play now, it's really for her sake, because
that monologue,
it's like a growing kind of trend, I guess, to perform King John. I've seen a couple performances online, and the emphasis is on Constance. But he is the character that changes the most in the play. Like, John changes his mind all the time, right? Which is what makes him, that's why he's like a really difficult character to play and to place, right? Because he's their true Machiavelli's going every wind of fortune. He's changing. But with I think with the Bastard, we have a character whose very identity, his core identity, changes at the very beginning of the play in Act One, Scene One, because he finds out he has a different father than he thought. He was the heir to this estate. He was an important man in England, the son of, is it Robert Falconbridge? And then he is given a new identity. And now all of a sudden he's the son of a king, but he's also a bastard, right? So he's both elevated and denigrated in this like immediate moment. And the rest of the play, he seems to be trying to find his way. And he's the character that's called multiple things in the script. Right, he's called both Bastard and Philip and Falconbridge, and he makes many claims to identity throughout the play. I am this name, right? And then in another scene, he'll call himself something different, and he is called upon to perform these terrible deeds, which on one hand is morally right as the subject of the king, and on the other hand, morally wrong because the things are asked that he's asked to do are terrible, immoral things, and he's very aware of it. There's this moment in Act 4, Scene 3, that is when he's talking to Hubert, who's the other character, I think, who has some morality to him.
Some integrity, yeah.
Yeah. And there's a really lovely conversation between the two of them about the fate of Arthur. And he says, he tells Hubert, go bear him in thine arms. I am amazed, methinks, and lose my way among the thorns and dangers of this world. And that, I think, is like integral to this character, and to the whole play. I think he is in some ways a stand-in for the self in general, like the capital S self, which is continually under attack and trying to navigate its way amongst multiple competing loyalties and vows and responsibilities. And I feel as the reader that I'm doing that in this play. And I think he is like a stand-in for me and for us in that sense. So I don't agree with every choice he makes, for sure. I think he makes the wrong choice sometimes. He's a bit too violent. He's rash. Like he is not a perfect character, but I think he is the moral center of the play because of that.
Heidi, I think that's so insightful. I'm going to make a little discursus here. When you and I were in Atlanta speaking at the Searcy conference, one of my talks was on leadership in Shakespeare. And as I kind of was researching for the talk, I had this conviction that if you're going to try to actually look for someone to emulate in Shakespeare's plays, it's hardly ever a king or a queen or a prince or a princess. And I didn't really connect the dots. I just kind of observed, okay, in Lear, you don't really follow the kings or the princesses, with the exception of Cordelia. You follow after Kent, who was probably a fictional character. Like there's enough kind of like back in history about Lear that there was probably a Lear. Anyway, same thing with Macbeth. There's like a real Macbeth. In my conversation with Peter Adamson, he thinks that the reason that we kind of look to secondary characters like Philip the Bastard is because we kind of already know the fate of the big names in the program.
Yeah.
Right? And I never thought about this, Sean. We know, oh yeah, John's going to die. And you know what? Arthur's going to die too. But these secondary characters, like maybe Philip the Bastard, we don't know as much about them. And so we kind of associate our attention on them because they're actually like free will characters that are making choices here. Same thing with the would-be assassin of Arthur. He decides, no, I'm not going to kill Arthur. And we kind of think like we would go and do likewise, but he's a secondary character. He's not kind of like fated because of history. Because
Herbert?
Herbert. That's right. That's right.
Hubert.
It is H-U-B-E-R-T.
Okay. Yeah.
Herbert sounds better.
I'll take it.
I'd like to talk about this speech by Constance, Heidi. I'm so glad that you brought it up. Having never seen or read the play before, this is one of like the joys of doing this show. You discover these gems And when she was doing her monologue, and I'm going to play it in just a moment, I was like, how have I never heard this monologue before? It is incredible. It's almost worth the whole play. And I can see why. I can read John as a sort of a warning against the horrors of war, because young Arthur is killed and all of the mothers of all of the young Arthurs in all of the wars in history, like, would love to issue this same complaint that Constant issues. Let's listen to this audio.
My name is Constance. I was Geoffrey's wife. Young Arthur is my son. And he is lost. I'm not mad. I would to heaven I were, for then 'tis like I could forget myself. And if I could, what grief should I forget? Oh, preach me some philosophy to make me mad, and I shall be canonized cardinal. Oh, if I were mad, I should forget my son.
That was Constance mourning the loss of her son, Arthur. If I were mad, I should forget my son. Heidi, were you familiar with this monologue before reading it in preparation for this podcast?
Yeah, I've seen a couple performances of it. And it is, I mean, it's just this emotional touchstone within the play. This play has at its heart an attack on a child, right? And like in Richard III, which I know you just recently did, Tim, that gives, like, that's such a heinous, wicked thing to do. And here we have the response of the mother, and she's just been warned, you know, she has her hair unbound. That's in the notes of the play that Shakespeare gives us. He doesn't give us a lot of scene directions, right? So when he does, they're always important. So her unbound hair is like her true self, right? And again, I think this play has a lot to do with the conflict between politics and personhood, mm-hmm. right? And she's continually warned, like, put back up your hair. We have a job to do, essentially. Mm-hmm. And they accuse her of being mad, right? You're mad with grief. And she says, no, I would be mad not to grieve.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Like my hair, my unbound hair and my, like, exposed and naked grief is the truest part of me. It would be madness for me to not identify myself in that very real emotional experience right now. You're asking me to do the mad thing, is what she's saying here. And I won't do it. She refuses. She chooses personhood over politics. And again, I think that's why, not only because of the grief, but because of that assertion of self, of personhood over politics in that moment, I think that's why it becomes such an emotional touchstone in the play. Nobody else has the freedom to do that. Not even Arthur the child. That's why it's so important in the play. Go ahead.
One of the things that I love about it is how incredibly simple the language is. My name is Constance. I was Geoffrey's wife. Young Arthur mm-hmm. is my son, and he is lost. I am not mad. I were to heaven I were. It's simple. I mean, especially for Shakespeare, it's simple words. It's very simple sentence construction. And it's just like grief from the actor. I just think it's so wonderful. One other little thing, I hesitate to attribute too much to Shakespeare, but I do wonder about this. I was Geoffrey's wife. Young Arthur is my son. Past tense to present tense, even though Arthur is dead. But I notice, if you guys have ever lost someone who's really close to you, I mean, I know this with my dad. For 2 years, I spoke of my dad in the present tense. It took a long time to start speaking of my dad in the past tense. And I just wonder, like, Is that a little psychological insight from Shakespeare? I mean, who knows? Maybe not, but
I think it is because Arthur is actually still alive here.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Right.
He's just condemned. Yes, I mean,
she's given him up as lost.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. So I think that that's purposeful for the reason that you say as well. And also, again, there's more assertions. There's lots of characters in the play that make simple assertions. Like you're saying, I am so-and-so, right? And she is identifying herself by her family, not her position here, right? She's not making any claims for Arthur on the throne anymore. That ship has sailed. She doesn't even care about that. She was the one angling so hard for his kingship. And he did have the right of primogeniture to the throne. Mm. Like, it doesn't belong to John. He was like, Arthur is the heir, not John. And so she was right. But here she's like, none of that matters to me anymore. The only thing that matters is my lost baby boy. And that's such a touchstone within the play.
Yeah.
Now, you know, Shakespeare does this thing. You talked about this all the time on the show, I'm sure. Like the idea of the royal speaking in blank verse, and there's a more of a form to it that's different from, you know, a commoner, the way they speak. When you read this, like, my name is Constance, I was Geoffrey's wife, I am not mad. Is Shakespeare playing with that blank verse there, you think? Because of the way I'm trying to scan it, and it feels like it doesn't scan blank verse exactly right, or if it does, you have to kind of make it fit. Sean, maybe you know more about this than I do. Also, you're like more active on the Daily Poem right now, thanks to you, thankfully. So, Tim, what do you guys think about this? Because I think this would fit with what Heidi's saying. It's not about the position; it's about the family. So, with Shakespeare strips away some of that blank verse, that's in keeping with that theme, that characterization that Heidi's suggesting there.
Well, it scans pretty well to me. Where do you think it falls apart?
Well, I mean, how do you scan Constance?
My name is stress on stress.
But I mean, so you would do
two
my
syllables.
Name is
my name and Constance is one. I was Geoffrey's wife.
I don't know. I don't think I would. I don't think I read it quite that way.
Maybe
being a little pedantic there, but it just, at least it doesn't seem like it scans as normally to me, but maybe Sean's just correcting me right now and he reads it differently.
For you, David, it reads a little ragged, or it's like there's not the kind of rhythm that you would ordinarily hear in like someone of noble birth speaking, declaiming publicly. Is that right?
Yeah, like it just slightly falls apart. I mean, that's, you know, but Sean and I may need to argue about this later. I don't know. What do you think?
I think that to Tim's point that you brought up, the language is so simple. It's so raw. It's so stripped of any kind of royal affectation. It's just raw. And I can see an actress playing this with like not being led by the scansion, the way that you normally would use the scansion, ride the scansion as an actor. Mm-hmm.
It seems like such a gift to the actor to not force it in that way.
Right.
The speech is, I mean, it to me, it still reads as iambic meter, but it's not confining. I think we've all said different versions of this. The speech is so simple and clear that you have a lot of freedom to pour yourself into it,
right?
Rather than just be carried along by it.
I want to take us back to the plot for just a moment so we can discuss the conclusion. Arthur is killed after a kind of treaty of sorts is signed in the middle of the play between John's niece Blanche and the French crown prince. They think, hey, look, we are absolutely at odds here. What's the only way to sign a treaty? A marriage, which is a very typical of the time. A marriage is a way to kind of like graft two warring families together. And so for a while, it works, but then it falls apart. And when it falls apart, Arthur is again recognized not as part of the peace, but as a threat to John's rule. So John commissions his death. As we discussed earlier, Hubert does not kill him, but Arthur does take his own life by throwing himself out the window. And that's what prompts Constance's speech. So after the marriage eased tensions, now we're back in the middle of the worst tension. We're at war. And eventually, French forces reach England. John submits to the Pope to get his aid, and rebellious nobles join against John. They're just like, forget it. We've had enough. They join the French. I mean, that's how bad it was. They joined the French. English nobles joining the French. So they return to John when they learn of the French prince plans to kill them. And then our conclusion, they force the bastard son of Richard I to expel the French. And then a monk poisons King John, and eventually his son becomes Henry III. So that's how we wrap up with the poisoning of John. A fitting conclusion to an unfit king. Is that how you guys see it?
Yeah. Maybe more or less.
Yeah.
For sure.
Well, and it's,
yeah, go ahead.
It does seem fitting too that is the method of his death. To return to the theme of the way that the church is presented in the play, because that I thought that moment, even though it's unclear what's going to happen to Arthur when the marriage is contracted in the middle of the play, I thought that moment where the papal legate shows up and undoes the peace.
Yeah.
Almost immediately after it's been forged, is when the play sort of turns to it into a tragedy.
Yeah.
All right. You have this possibility of a marriage union, like the mingling of bloodlines, putting an end to the war, and instead, the church arrives and insists that blood be shed.
Right.
And so the presence of the church has kind of been poisoning throughout the play. And of course, John has been also, you know, attacking and antagonizing the church through taxation, and et cetera. But then that final act to end John's life was also the kind of internal corrupting of the church.
Is thus an internal corrupting of poison. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
that seems fitting. And he's also like robbed of the potential dignity of dying in war, you know?
Yeah.
Like, as some sort
we
of,
know his insights are going to come out.
Yeah, right, right. David.
It happens off stage, right? His poisoning?
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Yeah. It's just reported that the monk who poisoned him and tasted the food to get him to consume it also, that's the fate that befell him.
I just sort of find it fascinating that, you know, we have this infamous king. Such that we won't retire his number in a good way, right? The English people will not. And on stage, Shakespeare doesn't put on stage the scene in which he dies. And we know that Shakespeare pulls off poisonings on stage. Like, that's not nothing, you know, he's killed monarchs on stage before, also with poison, if I'm not mistaken, as well as young lovers. But
Cleopatra gets bitten by a snake on stage.
Yeah, the snake on stage. Yeah. So, why do you think he does that in this particular case? That was one of the dramatic choices that I was most intrigued by.
So I think it's a little unclear how that staged. That was one of the big questions for me. There are a few moments in this play where the circumstance didn't make it obvious to me how something would be staged, and the coming and going of characters seemed to leave a lot of ambiguity. But John talks. He speaks on stage. And then we have, at least in my edition, we have a note that he dies, which seems to suggest he does die on stage. That first he's a talking character and then he's a corpse, because one of the someone even comments to the bastard, "Oh, you're speaking this news to dead ears," as if this is new information that John has been there, seeming to listen, and then he's no more.
He's gone.
So I thought he died on stage,
like a poisoned off stage, died on
poisoned
stage.
Off stage expires.
Slowly on stage.
Yeah, I guess but I was referring more to the action that leads to his death than like, okay, I don't really care where he breathes his last.
But even his last moments, like he doesn't get a Hamlet monologue or something. Yeah, he's just, he's there 1 minute and then they literally don't notice the moment of his passing.
Well, you mentioned, Sean, that, yeah, do you think that this play is a tragedy in the technical sense? Because I don't.
No, I don't think it's a tragedy in the technical sense. I think it is thematically Aristotle would have all kinds of problems with Shakespeare, but in the Aristotelian sense, I think it's tragic.
So the title of it is The Life and Death of King John, not the tragedy of King John.
Right.
And I think the reason, at least in my, this is an interpretive theory of mine, that John is not a tragic figure, but a villain.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. The tragedy is national.
Right.
It's not his own life and demise.
Right.
Which seemed just in many ways.
That, and I think that's probably why he doesn't get a monologue or any kind of like, you know, in a noble end at all. And I think that's why it's important to David's point that he's poisoned by an anonymous monk. And that his death is the solution to a potential solution to the problem of the play, because the problem of the play is John, and the problem of England is John.
It's John.
And if John hadn't been there, then we would have had a more noble and just society. And so he is the plague. He himself is the sickness and the fever that ought to be removed. And that's why his end is so fitting. He doesn't deserve a warrior's death. He doesn't deserve to die in battle. He doesn't deserve to be assassinated, right? He is the fever of England, and he dies by an ignoble fever.
Yeah.
And the next generations of kingship are going to be a little complicated.
That's right.
Leading up to that scene in Henry V where he's like, should my dad have done what he did? You know, it's like the question of kingship is like the rest of Shakespeare's plays, I guess, that are histories, but all of them probably to some degree.
Yeah.
Except his cowboy play.
Yeah. I mean, Succession. What do you mean by the cowboy play? What do you mean?
I'm just kidding.
I know. I'm like, I want to know that.
We'll tell you later.
What would the title of Shakespeare's cowboy play be?
All the Pretty Horses.
The Magnificent Seven.
Well done. Very well done. It actually kind of fits, doesn't it?
He says, he calls him the fever a tyrant. He says the tyrant fever. Mm-hmm. And then later on he says, when Prince Henry's son says, "Oh, that there were some virtue in my tears that might relieve you." I think we're supposed to see Prince Henry as a good successor here, although he didn't end up being very good for England, but he wasn't a wicked man like his father. He was more just kind of profligate. But King John responds, he says, "The salt in them is hot. Within me is a hell. And there the poison is, as a fiend confined to tyrannize on unreprievable condemned blood."
Hmm.
So his death is, and I'm going to use the word, right? Everybody take a shot. It is
an objective
correlative to the action of the play. And so his death is altogether fitting and just. And I think just like a really great, a really, really great move on Shakespeare's part.
Yeah.
I want to play that audio at the very end of the podcast, but we're not there quite yet. David.
I was just going to say, you were saying earlier, you weren't sure how much of the actual play we were going to be able to talk about. But you didn't account for the fact that you asked the three of us to come on this episode.
That's a great point. I should have known that you guys actually want to discuss Shakespeare.
And there's four of us.
I know.
So four of us. True, true. Yeah.
It's the last episode. Well, not the last episode of the play ever, but it's the last conversation on a play, and Tim's barely talking.
I know. This is great. This makes me really happy. I do want to go back. I think, Sean, you said Shakespeare doesn't give John his closing monologue. We get a little bit about the fever and about the poison, but there's nothing like Hamlet's close or anything like that. I'm just imagining if he tried to do that, you know, like, as you draw your last breath, remember my story. You know, whoever's on stage being like, no, actually, we're not. This is the best you're going to get is a Shakespeare play just because we have to cover it in history. But no, you're a cad. Fiend. You get no monologue.
His final lines would be his final lines in Robin Hood, the Fox Robin Hood. Mommy.
That's his last line?
Yeah, I think so. I think he's the last thing he gets to say in that is he like cries out for his mom.
Do you remember, this is
some kid's going to be like, that's wrong, scene. But you know.
There's a great scene in the Kevin Costner, like 90s version of Robin Hood. Prince of Thieves. Is it the king who wants to carve out Robin Hood's heart with a spoon? Do you remember this?
No.
That sounds right.
Snape.
It's Snape. And who's Snape? Yep. Is he the sheriff of Nottingham?
The sheriff. That's right.
I love that. So wonderful. That line, I want to cut his heart out with a spoon. Master, why not with a knife? Because it'd be more painful. It's such a great line.
Yeah.
You guys, we've reached the end.
Not ready.
I'm not ready either, Sean. But you know what? We have to be ready. I'm trying to think
the readiness
of like
is all.
The readiness is all. Thank you. Perfect.
Yeah.
I think like closing thoughts, highest stakes, last Shakespeare play on this podcast. I'm asking you guys to reach deep. Like, what is, like, give me one lasting memory from appearing on the show or just from Shakespeare in general. That's what I'm asking for. One memory from the show or one, like, a line, a character, a scene from Shakespeare that's going to stick with you. Sean.
I'll go first because mine's probably the least significant. I think I have come the farthest of us all. Because, Tim, I have vivid memories of downloading the Lear episodes to listen to while I mowed the lawn.
No way.
At that time, we had a big lawn. I had a riding lawnmower, and it took a long time. And I had these big old headphones, noise-canceling headphones, so I could listen to things. And I was listening to the Lear episodes, mowing the lawn. And now I'm here.
On the show.
On the final episode. Like a meteoric Plantagenet rise to...
like a usurper? Is that...
Yeah, hopefully the arc will continue in a positive direction. But I have... I remember distinctly, Tim, you saying something so helpful in one of those early Lear episodes where you interrupted the conversation and said something like, I think we have to clarify for our listeners what is meant by the word nature.
Mm.
And then you had this great discursus on the various and confused ways that the term nature is used by us and by Shakespeare. And it was so helpful. And from that moment on, I thought, this is going to be a good show.
That's great, Sean.
And I don't think you disappointed. I think the promise was fulfilled for sure.
That makes me happy. Thank you. David or Heidi, you guys have a memory or a favorite scene or a favorite line or character from Shakespeare?
Go ahead, Heidi. You seem like you got
like
one on the tip
too
of your tongue.
Many. I have way too many. So my first memory to share is that one time that I did Julius Caesar with Matt Bianco and Brian Phillips. Were you on that series even, Tim?
I wasn't.
No. So, and I know that because... you would never have done this, but we, that was before we could record individual files, and somebody who shall not be named forgot to push record. And so we did a whole episode and it was like a really good
no
episode.
No way.
I think it was,
sure it was.
Three. So it was like a for real, like you don't, you can't recreate a conversation about an act
right.
three.
Right.
And none of it was recorded. And then the whole next day we had to like redo it and try to create the magic.
Yeah, that's brutal.
I remember that.
So can I do an imitation of what I'm imagining this would sound like? Mm-hmm. It's, you know, Heidi is talking about Mark Antony's speech and she says, David, I think that Mark Antony's speech might be like the high point of Western.
Don't put this
rhetoric.
On me.
No, hold on. You got to let me. I'm setting up.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I think that Mark Antony's speech, his speech on rhetoric, might be like the high point in Western rhetoric. What do you think? Nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. It was funny actually, and we.
Oh, was it?
We had a little chuckle about it. Ha ha ha. But it was lost. It was a lost moment in time. That was a beautiful episode and nobody ever got to hear it. But we did re-record it and it was decently good the second time. And then another moment that I remember is when you and me and Andrew were recording Hamlet. Mm. And I got up, I was in Hawaii on vacation. And the only time Andrew could record was at like 8 in the morning is time. I got up.
What time was that for you? Oh my gosh,
I got
Heidi,
up
you're
four
so
in the morning to record an episode.
You were so devoted.
The thing about Hamlet. So those are just two little memories from the show. I have several like awakenings to things that happened on the air during discussion, things that I had never thought of before. One of them I remember in Richard II, which was one of my very favorite series, because I love that play so much and I got to be a promoter for that play. It's not very well known. People don't teach it or perform it. And I think they should. As you know, I'm like a huge advocate for Richard II. I think it's one of his most underrated masterpieces in the canon. I'm crazy about that play. I teach it every single year. I've never had a dull conversation about Richard II with anybody. And so I was really pleased to get to promote that and to be on that series. I probably told you I was like, I have to be on that one. You may not record that one without me. So I was grateful for that. So I guess those are just a couple little memories.
Heidi, I'm a complete convert, so much so that Galen and I were invited to like a little talent show next month. And the Richard II monologue, the Hollow Crown monologue, mm-hmm. that's the one that I'm doing. I'm memorizing it now.
Awesome.
It's so good.
Awesome.
David, as the
that speech every year. All right, go ahead.
Wait, say it again. You
I said I make my students memorize that speech every single year.
Because it's so wonderful.
Speech. Which speech is it? Like which one are you talking about?
When he's giving up his crown.
The crown that mount rounds the mortal temples of a king.
Oh right, yeah. Okay, yeah. Yeah. Just for people who don't remember exactly which one is the Hollow Crown.
Yeah.
With the
none of those people are here.
David, what is your as the granddaddy of the show, a memory.
So I remember doing those Macbeth episodes with you early on in Close Reads history and thinking, okay, we need to do more Shakespeare. And then thinking, like as we were thinking about how to sort of shape Close Reads and all that, thinking, well, Shakespeare needs something more than just a play a year or, you know, dropping in Hamlet here in between The Sun Also Rises and Pride and Prejudice or something, which that sounds like a great year of reading. Yeah. But, you know, like in terms of doing a podcast on it, it needs more commitment. It needs, you know, we need to actually like Shakespeare matters. Let's talk about it. But I have probably been on, I haven't been on in a long time. And I remember talking to you about it. And like you, how excited you were and how knowledgeable you were and just being like, really what we need is we need a Tim show. We need a place for Tim to go do his thing. And I remember basically being like, Tim, why don't you just make this your own thing? I think we had a conversation, something like that effect. And it's one of the best suggestions. It was a suggestion. Best suggestions I've ever made, because you took the show and you ran with it and you made it incredible and you made it so, like, an incredible resource for people. And I'm so glad you're going to run old episodes back through, because reminding people of that resource that is out there is so valuable. Like when you're teaching Hamlet, when you're teaching, whether you're teaching a play like that not enough people read like Richard II, or that everybody reads like Macbeth or Romeo and Juliet or Hamlet, the resources that you've created on this show, along with all your different collaborators, of which I am like the least, I mean, I'm, thank you for thinking of me for this episode, but like the least qualified person to do this. You have so many great people on, which I think, I'm sure you're going to shout them all out as well. And you just made an incredible thing. Like, you immediately took it, you added the little bits of audio and the little bits of production, and you and Logan worked so well together. So I think in all my years of doing podcast production stuff, like having these conversations with all different kinds of people who are talented, I think suggesting you take it and run with it was one of the best things that I ever suggested.
Oh, that's really nice.
I don't say that. I'm trying to make this not sound like something I did.
No,
this thing incredible, and it was awesome to listen. And you've done an incredible job with this. This is an amazing resource for people. So well done.
Thank you, David.
The play truly is the thing.
The play truly
is
the thing.
And like you kept it there. You didn't like make it about the other stuff. You made it about the play, and that's why it's valuable.
I appreciate that very much. Thank you very much. Listen, I'm going to close with one quick memory. This is maybe my best memory. When we were recording Taming of the Shrew, I met Galen, and she told me much later that she would listen to the Taming of the Shrew podcast as she was going to bed at night when we were like just starting to get really serious. And I was like,
yeah, that'll do it.
That's strong. And the funniest thing was, is she would talk to me about Taming of the Shrew, and she would have such strong opinions. And I would say, so you read the play? No, I didn't. I just listened to the podcast.
Well, it's, to be fair, every now and then you do drop those sweet, sweet podcasts, that like the tones you have. You got
the
a good
sweet,
voice for
mellifluous tones, podcaster tones.
Right. Next thing you know, now you got a baby.
Apparently it worked. thanks, you guys, for coming back on and regrouping for this podcast. It's been an honor. And we're going to leave you with a little bit of King John's sad last words. Thanks for being part of the show.
Poison. You fair dead forsook, cast off. And none of you will bid the winter come to thrust his icy fingers in my maw. Or let my kingdom's rivers run their course through my burnt bosom. Nor entreat the north to make his bleak winds kiss my parted lips and comfort me with cold. I do not ask thee much, I beg cold comfort. And you are so strayed and so ungrateful, you deny me that.
Oh, that there was some virtue in my tears that might relieve you.
The salt in them is hot. Within me is a hell. And there the poison is as a fiend, confined to tyrannize on unreprovable, condemned blood.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.